Mr. Hayes, Real 7. We were talking about, the operations in late July and then into August, Operation Blue Coat, or the Advance. Yes. And we'd actually got on to talking about the Padre. Yes. You wanted to say some more about the Padre.
The Padre, he did. He got the MC in the end. And it was presented to him in Ypres by Montgomery. Pinky Hutchinson got his MC there, and so did Steel Gangley. I had a picture of him somewhere, but I've lost it now. But anyway, so things went on, and then we got this situation where the tank I didn't recognise, which happened after I'd come off the ARV, after we'd been through Fleur.
So what do you remember of that period then? What duties did you do on the ARV during that?
Well, there was nothing until you didn't do a thing until there was a vehicle either ditched or got to be moved or...
And that didn't happen while you... No. It sounds like you weren't on it for long.
2 or 3 weeks, I think. Or maybe only 2 weeks, I don't know, I can't remember. And then we got to the situation where I was back on a B vehicle, where we ran into that situation where Steve Brownie proudly said that he'd been shellings from horse-drawn...
Well, could you tell us about that? Remember, we haven't heard that on the tape.
Yeah. Well, anyway, eventually, I don't know what happened. I don't know why he was taken off the ARV. Maybe it wasn't well or something. And I was put on this other...
Was this another ammunition lorry?
It was either ammunition or petrol. I have a feeling it was petrol. And Tony Pope was the driver at that particular time. And we were going through a forest. And we were going up this hill. And I think maybe whether we were the tail end of the convoy, I don't know. But anyway, we could hear the firing on the top. And halfway up this hill, fairly narrow road, Tony Pope missed a gear. And it's because it was four-wheel drive, if you missed a gear, and there was no way of fettling it. So anyway, eventually I said, what are we going to do? So he said, well, what can we do? So he said, we'll just have to sit here and see what happens. Well, I think I told you this before. When we were looking down the road, because we were both out of the wagon, we saw this column of German troops coming, and I said, I don't want to worry you, Tony. Look what's coming up the road. And it was not armoured, but, sort of motorcycle, troops and that sort of thing. And I think maybe a few German half-tracks. And in the distance, there was an intersection of a crossroad. And fortunately for us, it turned left. And I said, oh, thank God for that. So eventually they sent a truck down and we offloaded. It was obviously an empty truck. So we offloaded what was on ours into the truck they sent down. So we were then towed up onto the top. And this is where Tony said to me, right, we're getting towed back to wherever, the assembly area. He said one of the other wagons took us in tow to take us back to the, obviously, B echelon or whatever it was. And he said, don't bother coming in the car with me. Get on the back of the wagon. There's a 0.5 on a tripod, solid tripod there. And he said, if we run into any trouble, just put my fire with this 0.5. So when we start to go along the ridge of this, we look down, there was some Germans, sort of half crouched alongside this wall. And the other side of the wall was about 3 or 4 French colonial troops with the red fezzes on. And I thought, well, should I open fire or not? I thought, no, I don't know who will hit. I don't know whether the French or the Germans. So I left it. When we start to come down the other side of this, off this ridge, and we got part way down, and there was a burning vehicle on somewhere there, and it was just obscuring the whole road ahead of us. And as we came through the smoke, there was about 3 of these Cromwell tanks, but with a huge turret on them and a long gun, came towards us, swung you know, from where they were to confront us, really. And it wasn't, and they're going to, and they just look like an old German tank to me. I'd never seen a Cromwell that shape with such a turret on it. It was an ugly looking beast, and I think it was called a Challenger, but they brought another tank out called the Challenger. But I've got a book somewhere with one of those in. And
so what happened? Did they open fire on your...
No. They realised at the last minute that they were friendly. So anyway. So that was that episode. But then we sort of started. They didn't tell us much. They just said, we're going that way, or follow that, you know. So anyway, we got down, and we were on to heading for Falaise. So this is quite a bit, you know, a few days later.
Anything else happening between?
No, not that I can remember. We were obviously moving, but I don't know what happened. But the one thing that sticks in my mind, we got down by... We were edging onto an American, or what had been an American sector, which I think was it Argentina? No. What's it called? I've already got that one here. And we were in this field with the vehicles, and it's a thing that brought me up with a jolt, because I didn't want to see it, but you know, where somebody says, come and have a look at this. And we're in this field, and this lad, who was a bit of a stupid goat, and he said to me, hey, Doug, come and have a look at this. And in the far side of the field, there was this American wagon on its own. And it was one of these, a six-wheeler, you know, quite a big one, quite high. And with a tarpaulin over it, you know, the slatted side of the tarpaulin. And he said, so what's so strange about that? And he lifted the sheet up and he said, have a look at that. And I said, I wish I hadn't seen that. And it was packed with American bodies, and they were about 8 deep. And, you know, that changed my views on war, how to see it starkly done like that, just bodies. Oh, obviously thrown in and nose, you know, but no cover on them at all, no cover inside the truck. And this is why I couldn't understand why the Americans insisted in going around the battlefields collecting bodies. I didn't like it, because once they got past that, they would be just bodies. You know, there was no...
What?
There was nobody there to say a bit of a prayer over them. However, you know, and I'm not a religious person, but it struck me. I thought, this is one of the obscenities of war. And it was, too. The Americans always did it, but later on in the day, two Americans came in, and I think they probably could have been Jewish padres, and they both had a bucket apiece. And they were going around picking up bits of bodies, because, you know, the Jewish faith, entirely different than ours, they would go and pick, you know, bits of legs up. And I thought, to me, it was ghoulish, really. And it really, you know, it brought it down to me. I thought, well, no, I think our idea is a much better idea. During the course of that in Normandy, whenever the party appeared, and he was looking for somebody to come and dig a grave, I would go with others. And I used to take the attitude, well, they were our people, and they were mainly from the tanks. And I wasn't in a tank. So the last I can do, not expect the tank crews to dig the graves. I would always go and dig a grave. And it's the first time I saw a burial. And there were two officers, very young officers, about this. I remember burying them very well. And what they did, I didn't know the score, just said what they wanted. And they would arrive on an ambulance or something. And they were tightly wrapped in a blanket, an army blanket. The padre had obviously gone through their pockets and, you know, got it for the next of kin. And it always stuck in my mind that.
How deep were the graves? I mean, were they full deep or
no,
the shallow ones?
Quite shallow, because they'd come and sort of salvage them after we'd gone. Maybe about deep or shallow.
But
yeah.
2'6".
Yeah. But
and how would the grave? Would they take the dog tags out?
I don't know why they took that, because when they came, to the graveside, they would be wrapped in a blanket, and we wouldn't even know who they were.
And how would the graves be marked? How would the graves be marked so that they could collect them later?
Oh, the padre would make sure that he had a wooden cross with the name on. And the fellow that made the wooden crosses was my driver's brother. It was John Nicholson. I forget what the other fellow's name was. But he was the one that made the crosses and painted the white ones. And the padre was very, very good. But he said to me after, he said, every time something happens within the unit, particularly from Fife and Clover Young, from the area there, he said invariably if there was some quirk in the death, although they'd been informed, I would invariably get a letter from somebody in the area asking for further details. And he said, what could you do? He said, you just thought out the best way you could. And he was a real character.
Now, what other things were you doing? What were your sort of daily duties, you know, on the petrol lorry?
Well, whenever they needed petrol, they would call for us and we'd go up to wherever they were, or they'd come back into our lager or liga and sling the driver and his co-driver would get on the back of the tank, and we would carry a thing about that big, like that, you know, oblong thing about that.
About a yard by foot and a half.
And what they used to, and it had a thick pipe coming from it, and they'd put it into the, you know, the tank unit, and they'd just open a jerry can and just tip it up and leave it running in. And you throw another one up to them, and that's the way they fueled in, you know, in a hurry, because they could never hit a little hole like that. You know, sort of pull them out of a jerry can. And then we used to carry these.
So it was like a trough?
Yeah.
And then it had a pipe?
Yeah.
And you just carried jerry cans in the back of your lorry?
Yeah, yeah.
How many would you carry? Or was it full? Or
pretty full. They'd obviously work out how many, you know, a 3-tonner would carry, weight-wise. And but the strange thing was, after we towed this Tony Pope's wagon back, I never saw him for 3 months. The people in the area were so pleased to see them. They were very loath to let them go, and they started forming football teams and all sorts of things. He said at the time, like, oh, I said, bully for you. But it was. And then the next place we hit was Vernon. Now, I don't know what had happened. These things happen. And I was driving at the time, and I had a corporal with me, and we crossed this...
So you were second driver to this corporal?
No, the corporal, I don't know what he was. He was a corporal, and he hadn't been long with the unit. And he said to me, we were crossing this little bathing bridge, one of these, you know, bridges, a pontoon bridge, and there and to the other side, and he said, a lot of French people the other side, and they would see him, and I said, the first one that shakes my hand, he said, I'll spit in his eye. So I said, why? He said, because I was here in 1940. And he said, we went up through this way, and we came back on retreat this way. And he said, they threw insults after insults at us. He said, we've got no time for them. The only time they're interested is when we're winning. So I think I've lost my belly there and all. Had hell of a job replacing. But
did you share his view, or did you just you?
I don't know. I don't know. The French were funny. Sometimes they were, you know, very gushing, and other times they weren't very communicative. And being as that none of us spoke a word of French except, you know, sort of bonjour, madame, monsieur, or madame, or whatever it was, and. Then apparently they said that they would then get the two divisions side by side, the two active divisions, which was ours, and the guards were on our right hand. And apparently, when I read from the book, I wouldn't know it at the time, that they decided, whoever it was, the powers that be, that we would advance through the night. it was going to be a moonlight night. It was black as pitch. And we started off, and...
This is the Advanced Amiens on, I think it's about third, at the end of August.
Yeah. The reason I put Amiens, because I didn't know the place, actually. But it was all I knew was we stayed overnight at somewhere near Vimy Ridge. And I know that because one of the officers came in and said to us, there were quite a lot of us there, held up all the money. And they said, we had thought of taking a couple of wagons up to Vimy Ridge to have a look at the wonderful memorial. But he said, we've had second thoughts, there's a possibility the Germans would mind it. So you're not on. So anyway, we stayed there, and we were in the village hall. And it was another one thing that sticks in your mind. We were in with the villagers there, and they were all crowding around and singing and shouting and what have you. And the first time I've heard the Marseillaise sung with gusto. And during the evening, one of the villagers came up and said to us, "We have got your pipe band." Well, we haven't got a pipe band. We've got one piper. And then we realised that it was the first fighting forces who had been in the first BEF. He said, "Well, when the Germans, when you your people," he said, "we buried them, and we've still got them." So, whoever it was that was in there, we said, "Oh," and we never bothered because it wasn't our band. And even if you had a band, we'd got enough. One piper was enough for us, but we couldn't play in tune. And so we kept stum. And it wasn't until long after that this officer came up with the wonderful information that the first fighting forfeiture band was in this particular village. And they had retreated from there when I looked in the what's name book, war book. And so that was the thing that, who'd you tell? The strange thing about that was that there was a... I'll tell you that later on because I'm shooting off my story again. Eventually, we got on... I'm going back on the ARV again. Well, strange thing that happened.
Go on, Ed, tell us that.
It was when we were moving forward on the ARV and we were in a column of tanks. And suddenly, bear in mind, we were going parallel with the coast, so the places we were bypassing, like Calais and places like that, were on our left. And suddenly all the tanks swung their guns round onto the right. And I said, "What's going on?" And occasionally a crumbly popper would have taught with a pair of binoculars. And what it was, there was a young French couple celebrating their liberation with gusto in the field. And the whole lot, if any of the officers had come along and realised that they weren't bothering what was going to come on our left, they were more interested in, I don't think they gave them a round of cheers in the end. But it's just one of those stupid things that you remember. But eventually we went hell for leather down towards Antwerp. The guards shot off towards Brussels. Now, I and our echelon didn't go into Antwerp. We were, Boom Artsler, which was just outside. It was quite well documented to Boom Artsler. I don't know why. But we didn't go into Antwerp. And we stayed there. Didn't know much of what went on in Antwerp, actually. But eventually we got the order to move. And this was the time of... almost coming up to the time of Arnhem, I think. I don't know. And because the guards were on the right, they got the honour of going up to Arnhem to relieve them. So they weren't very successful then. The comment was after, and we said, think about you making that statement. You might have been here if you'd have gone up the corridor. The guards decided that they were had a night's rest on that day, and that one 12 hours or 24 hours was a vital thing. And I know from our divisional commander, he'd have said, you can't go anywhere, you've got to stay on the road, so you may as well keep going, as long as you don't run off the edge and into a minefield or something. And that 12 or 20, about 12 hours, I think, made all the difference from getting through to it to Arnhem. But that's another story. But what happened then? And then we faffed around in that corridor around by Nijmegen and places like that. And then eventually we were getting almost up to Christmas. And they decided, well, the powers that be decided that we were going to go back for this wonderful reef there, which we did eventually. And I said, I went on the stands, you know, in the vicinity, and I said, Len Debley and I can't remember the driver's name, that was the Corporal Storman, and the driver, who was a very, very quiet fella, he said they put him for a Brussels leave. I said to Stan, what do you think? He said, I think you're a bloody fool, we're going back into Belgium shortly. You may as well, you know, stick there. Anyway, Keith Sangman was the driver. And he was quite a well-educated fellow, really, well-spoken. And his father-in-law was a padre in the Air Force. And he used to invite him to these, you know, officers' mess dues. And I said, how did he get round the fact that you were the trooper, you know? He said, well, I used to go in service for one thing. And he said, I was always introduced as Mr. Sangman of the tanks, which is a lovely get round. But they were killed in the wreck similar. There was quite a few went down there, but what the rest of them, they were crafty. They'd all sort of done time in Brussels. So as soon as they got to Antwerp, they got on transport to Brussels. So, but anyway, the one Cockney lad, Bill Wood, and he was an ex-London policeman. He went round, found where the bodies lay, and he said, I went and I found the two people concerned, how are you? And he said, the watches had gone, the wallets had gone, and everything. And you stepped down to the ground, and he said, whether it was the Pioneer Corps that got them all out, I don't know. But he was not best pleased. And of course, then it left me, it was the only one on that fitter truck, then it left me the next day with sorting out Len Debley's personal effects for his brother. It was also a textile, but in another squadron. So it was a bit of a sad, you know, shortcoming, that sort of thing. But we weren't there much longer, and I said to somebody, when are we going back to, you know, we didn't know where we were going, into Belgium. He said, when we capture America. I said, well, that's a long shot. But there was a place called Little America in that area, and it was one of our jobs to capture. But one thing that did, we were, in the end, we shoved them out of it, and in the end, we were put onto farms, and the farm that we were put in, our particular section, Stan was in the one further down on the Helmand Road, I think. And it was a pig farm. And the warmest place in that farm was a pigsty. And you could, after the first 5 minutes, you couldn't smell the pigs, and the pigs couldn't smell us, obviously. But because they were scrupulously clean, these, you know, Dutch farmers. And what used to happen was, every night, there used to be a plane, a German spotter plane came, and it was a jet. And what it would do, it'd come down and it'd follow the line of the road, you know, from left to right, if you know what I mean. Going like a bat out of hell. And every now and again, give a blast of them, the machine guns, where they'd seen them on the road. But because they couldn't trust us to keep awake, and we were supposed to be guarding them, because we had a few of our cooks were actually captured. We think we gave them up actually to the Germans. But a few of our cooks disappeared because they could come across in the night infiltrate. And so they decided what they would do is have somebody away from the farm buildings, take a firing pit really, or like a foxhole, and we'd go out on twos and have a Bren gun with us, and we'd go out and God, it was bitterly cold.
So you were guarding the B echelon position?
Guarding the you know, what's the name, in case somebody get
A echelon, sorry,
So anyway, then what used to happen, and we didn't cotton on for a while, when this plane came over, Stan and the rest of the fitters were in the farm down the road, which was about 500 yards away, something like that. And every time this plane came over, a light appeared in this farm. So whoever was with me at the time, he said, next time that door opens, that light comes on, I'm going to give it a blast of this plane. Which he did. So, and then from that farm, they had a blast at us then, and this went on for some time. And all it was they didn't fancy being in the house when this jet came over. So they would open the door and forget to switch the light off when they opened the door. So we get the signal. You didn't know, they were diving for the switching somewhere. But we took it the other way. And in the end, it ended up in the right pitch battle. And there was no way of stopping it. So one of the officers came round and to our farm and said, what the hell do you think you're doing? That's the farm where the rest of our fitters are. So anyway, but that you know, sort of calmed down all right. But that was another one of these strange things. So we then sent back into Helmond, I think it was. It was Helmond and Dern, I can't remember which was which. But we were sent into Helmond, I'm sure. And we were in Sibby billets.
What were they like?
They were very, very primitive because the place that people we were billeted on, and we didn't have any, they didn't give us any creature comforts. They just left them as the way they were. And one night we were having a wash in the kitchen there, and a knock came at the door. And there was a fellow from the 15th Scottish, or two of them actually, with the Tommy Shanties on and the bubble on top. And he said, their first question was, which one are you with? Apparently we didn't realise we'd been billeted in a bottle. So we said, you don't know anything about it. How lucky can you get? Well, they were right pair of scrubbers, the two women that were in there, and the husband or whoever it was. I don't know, but he was it. And all they seemed to eat was potatoes. Very, very meagre fare as far as we could say. But anyway, we got friendly with a couple of girls, I don't know who it was, and we went to the pictures with them a few times, that sort of thing. And I said about this, and they said, oh, she would be a strunt wife, which means in Dutch, whatever, a prostitute. So anyway, we said, we didn't want to know. So anyway, while we were there, he got all sorts of local things happen. St. Nicholas came out on horseback with a kid with a sack of shot or something with him, and all sorts of traditional things, you know. But that was before we moved. And then while we were down there, we had lumped in with our section this French fella. Frenchie, we called him. And he tagged along in quite a scary fact, but I don't know about it. It was something to do with Blue Coat. And he volunteered to give somebody some information about what's the name of the troops, and very good information. And he was crafty so-and-so, and he asked could he join one of the units. Because, they said, maybe he waited up. We thought, well, he'd done some good work for us, so why not? So he was sent to A Squadron. And he was a fluent, obviously a fluent French speaker. But he used it to his advantage to a lot. And we didn't particularly like him because he played some real underhand tricks.